Thank you for listening to the Following Films podcast. Today I have something special. I have two different interviews. On the first half of the show, I'll be talking to the China brothers, Benjamin and Paul China, about their film Night Shift. While working her first night shift at a remote hotel, a woman begins to suspect that the property is haunted. I had a great time with this film, and it's currently available on Amazon Prime. Then after the break, I'll be joined by Adam Cooper to talk about his Russell Crowe thriller, Sleeping Dogs. The film follows an ex-homicide detective with memory loss who's forced to solve a brutal murder, only to uncover chilling secrets from his forgotten past. Sleeping Dogs is a hell of a good time, and it'll be in theaters this Friday. Hope you enjoy the show. Where are you guys at?
We're in Los Angeles, man. We're in my house, but I mean, we're from England, but we've been over here for a few years. Fortunately, we still hang on to our accents, but
I know. That's an impressive setup you got behind you. Are they DVDs?
DVDs, Blu-rays, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I'm still a physical media nerd. So
love it, man.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So are you guys? Go ahead. What's that?
You got the Jaws poster behind you. What's the poster here that's closest to you?
It's for the Ranger.
The Ranger.
It's a movie that was produced by Larry Fessenden, directed by Jen Wexler. It's a really cool little movie. So
I'm going to write that down.
I think it's on Shudder right now. So.
Oh, it's amazing. The Ranger. Terrific.
Okay, great.
So are you guys physical media guys then, or?
You used to be.
Yeah.
Until I had children. That kind of, you know, they just throw through everything. I even used to have collect, I had this wonderful figurine from, my mind's going blank here, from my buddy Valentine. And it was
nice.
I had it on my desk and just destroyed, you know. And it's after that, it's like, oh my gosh, all the books have to be up as high as possible. I wish.
I think the only thing now is like really keeping a strong vinyl collection, particularly for like genre soundtracks. That seems to be it. And books as well. I just have to have physical books. But I kind of wish I still had all my Blu-rays.
Same.
Yeah, this was in the garage until we just bought a new house in January. And so for the last, you know, I don't know, 10 years or so, I've been keeping them in the garage because I had kids and that kind of thing. Now I can actually bring it into the house again, which is nice. So I'm allowed to take over this little square.
I love it. It's like, it's going back to when we were boys. It's like when you
I haven't matured. I mean, my sense of my aesthetic taste is exactly the same as when I was 17 years old. So it's still Jaws posters and crappy genre shit all over the house. But thank you so much, guys, for taking the time to do this. I really appreciate it. This is one of my favorite accidental viewings of a movie I've had in a long time. The publicist sent me the wrong link. I was scheduling a different interview, and so they sent me the link to the film, and I started watching this, and I was like, well, that's not the title of the movie, but that changes sometimes on the preview screen and everything. And I was watching it, I was like, fuck, this looks really good. This is interesting. This isn't what I'm supposed to be watching tonight, but I'm into this, because I watched basically till the point where we're introduced to Yogi, and I was like, okay, I'm on board for this. Whatever in God's name this thing is, I want to see this movie. And then I went back and I looked it up a little bit. Like, okay, so it's the guys that wrote Sweet Virginia. This is something that's wildly different than tonally from Sweet Virginia. But I'm on board. I'll check this out. And man, I'm so thankful for this accidental send, because this is just what a wonderful little discovery. So I really enjoyed the movie, guys.
That's amazing. I love that story. I'm glad you were accidentally sent it.
Well, this is the exact kind of movie that's right in my wheelhouse. One that is. I think it's very smart. It doesn't insult the audience. I think that there's a direction the movie's heading in that I feel like I don't want to give anything away, obviously, but the whole time the movie is telling you what it is. And if you're paying attention, you can kind of know where this is going. And it's either one of two things. Either these are really fucking bad choices somebody's making that make no sense, or it's this other thing. And I'm hoping it's this other thing. It turns out it was the other thing. So I was very happy with that in the end.
It was, yeah, especially with with a movie like Night Shift coming out with our debut, it's one location, small cast, small crew. And so it's about how do we subvert audiences' expectations, particularly when it comes to the ghost story. And how do we sort of meticulously design the film and shoot the film in a way that keeps the audience engaged and hopefully provide them with really unique scares and sort of a couple of little twists and turns here and there. And just to be visually compelling and sort of not let them down, because audiences are smart.
They're so smart. So it's like Paul said, it's that you have to be, we had to be very meticulous in planning the story and the structure, knowing that we only had this like one location to work in, to try and keep it engaging, to try to keep those scares alive, and to also like place good moments of levity throughout it, because you know horror and comedy are two sides of the same coin. So it's learning how to like release tension and then bring it up again and just keep this narrative going and knowing when to reveal certain information, those right beats. Well,
and it's, you have this, even though it's one small location, you still have, because it's taking place in this motel, you get the chance to introduce these very interesting, eccentric characters every, you know, so 15 minutes or so, you get to meet these brand new people, and you can do things that are people that are introduced for scares. You have people that are introduced for just pure comedy sake. I feel at times, you know, you go from people that it's either you're watching something from a John Waters movie at one moment, like watching something from, you know, like a Fincher movie in another second for a half. And it, so and you're kind of vacillating between those worlds. And I think that it's something that is pretty remarkable, because it never loses sight on the other half of the movie, where that balance between horror and comedy, oftentimes you lean too heavily into the comedy and the scares aren't there, or you lean so much into the scares that the comedy just feels like it's out of left field and it doesn't work. And I feel like this is something that balances both those really well.
Thank you for saying that. It definitely was introducing those characters in there. How do we make it different? I think even with the motel owner, you know, in any sort of cliche version of this kind of story, you've got like an old, scary, cantankerous man who you don't believe or what have you. So we were like, well, why don't we cast Lamour Morris?
And he's great.
He's amazing. And it's the last thing an audience expects. Like, Lamour Morris is running this motel? And we think of that. And also, I mean, just, you know, like Patrick Fischer and Lauren Bowles, the rich white couple that come in the middle of the film, just, you know, wearing the bow tie and the dresses, and who are married in real life and who are absolutely extraordinary, just to have them come in and give a breath of fresh air in the middle of all of this kind of suspense and tension building was really, really fun to play with. And we just hope it works with audiences, you know.
Including setting the motel in a desert as well, which we thought would be a unique perspective that hasn't sort of really been done before. Like most motel settings in genre movies are in the woods or, you know, or perhaps in like a mountain region. So by doing it in a desert, we hope that would give a fresh perspective into this narrative that could be familiar to audiences.
Well, I thought it was a call to Psycho, honestly, just with her driving from Arizona into the middle of the desert. And that, I kind of felt that that's at least what I was when I was watching the first 15 minutes of this movie the first time around. When I was watching this, that's what I was thinking. I'm like, okay, this feels like a little bit, it's playing in that area, and especially the taxidermy and these other things that are introduced in that. I kind of felt like that's where, was that not the case, what you were thinking of in that?
Oh, no, it's, definitely the two biggest influences were Hitchcock Psycho, which is the most obvious one, and then also Mario Bava's Kill Baby Kill.
Yeah,
because it's so much more than a ghost story. That film's a masterpiece. And like, everybody always usually talks about Black Sunday, Black Sabbath, Blood and Black Lace, you know, which is, they're all brilliant, but Kill Baby Kill is so much more than a ghost story. And it's set in the 18th century, but you have a character that's staying at an inn, and so like again, it felt like it could tie in with Night Shift, about having somebody that's staying at a place where other people convene. And then we kind of, we start to go, what am I seeing? Is it supernatural or not? And then that was definitely an influence in that way.
Absolutely. And to have those scares and to have that supernatural element to tie into the narrative, to make it grounded, to make it real. So it's not just like off the cuff or something that's thrown away, to make it really emotional and imperative to the story.
And where you go in the third act of this film, if you're not setting up those pieces properly in the beginning of it, you won't buy into it, because it can be a pretty out of left field turn for people, that because you are leaning into the emotion of that, there's almost when I saw some of the effects design of the creatures, monster, whatever, this spirit, whatever you want to call this, I was thinking of like The Devil's Backbone. It's something that was utterly grounded in humanity. It felt something, there was a sadness to this that I was feeling. And so I think that comes through. And actually, once you know the whole story, it does surf into that, but it goes in a different direction than maybe I was anticipating in the end with that.
And to rely on practical effects, I think, to sort of go back to old school filmmaking techniques, which we grew up with, you know, ever since we saw, you know, The Prowler and, you know, The Burning, and looking at Tom Savini's best work, and just going, well, this, the audiences are smart, like we were saying before. Like, you have CGI blood on screen, we know it's a cop-out. So, you know, even if we only have one chance to get this right, you know, with makeups on ghosts or what have you, or, you know, with blood effects, we took that opportunity and we took that risk because the audience deserves it, especially the horror community, because they know that, we're paying service to everything that came before. And that has the best visceral effect on an audience.
Absolutely. I also think being like scrupulous in that, I know we said it before, but scrupulous in the design to lead up to that third act. It's like, place little moments throughout that make sense for it to, once things get revealed or what have you, like there's a little clue spread out if you wish to indulge in them.
Well, it's something that I have a feeling that it will, a rewatch, there's a lot of things that are being left through here that you'll be able to pick up on the second time through, because this is something that doesn't feel like it was tacked on. It feels like this is a thoughtful film where you are moving from one piece to another, where the way that each moment aligns with the next, that it's something that is really well constructed, where it feels like you really couldn't move any parts of this around, that it has to go in this order and in the sequence for it to really work, which is just because this is a really tight film. I don't feel an ounce of fat on this thing. It does not overstay its welcome one frame, and it feels like it was cut down to the absolute essentials.
Yes, thank you for saying it, Christopher. And to keep it engaging and entertaining as well, you know, even though, you know, at times, like particularly with Phoebe, who gives such a wonderful performance, we were so lucky to cast her.
Yeah.
You know, she's on screen for 95% of the time, and then she's in certain scenes where she's just by herself and just, you know, engaging with the motel. And we needed somebody who not only was a, you know, a terrific actress, but had tremendous screen presence that could hold the audience's attention. And to keep it entertaining and engaging as we started to lay out these beats building up until the third act, we were fortunate. It was a thrill ride to do it.
Yeah, and every single scenes that she's in is imperative to the design of the film. It's not like throw away, but even if she's cleaning the motel, it still serves a part of the structure.
Well, it's all the little pieces that are being laid out that pay off later, but you're right, because she makes a lot of horrible choices that are really questionable throughout this film. And so, but it's in that performance that you're still compelled by her. And you want to, a lot of times in genre pieces, when you have somebody that makes really just bad choices, it'll pull you out of it. And in this, when she's making these choices, you go, what are you doing? Why would you go knock on that door in the middle of the day? What the fuck is wrong with you? But it's just clearly this is somebody, you don't know why she's there. And so there's something you're interested in finding out what's going on with her, even if everything she's doing just does not make sense. So, but that's a special performer to pull that off.
Yes. And she did it so well. And come the third act, it makes sense, you know, and you can kind of, you can buy into that, but, it's always difficult with horror with genre cinema to sort of to focus on that and to make the audience believe in a character and why a character is making those choices. And especially when it comes down to performance. So again, with Phoebe, we were so fortunate to cast her.
Yeah, kind of reminds you a bit when you look back at like Polanski's Repulsion, even, you know, with the lead actress in that movie who's just making all these decisions. And as we watch it, sometimes we're like, well, why are you doing that? You know, it's just completely the wrong thing to do. And then third act, it makes complete sense.
Absolutely. And my god, the name dropping in here, it's like going through everything from The Burning, which I just picked up not that long ago, to Pulsion, one that I need to, I think that was the Jason Alexander's first movie, I think, or something like that.
It was The Burning, right? Yeah, it is his first film.
It's an interesting one to go revisit, because there's these things that those were the movies I'm 47, so those are the movies I was raised on, those things. And it's going to see genre films like that I would go see them at the Art House Theater because that's the place that played those. So you would have, you know, The Burning playing on one screen, and then you'd have Kurosawa's Dreams playing on the screen next to it. And so in my mind, I've always seen those types of films as the same thing, because I would go to the same place to take those in. And so I have a feeling the two of you were raised in a similar way. I feel like there's a similar language here where you are. It's, yeah, it's Polanski, but it's also, you know, kind of like trashy grindhouse stuff. And there's a lot, there's good, there's beauty in both.
100%. So well said, Christopher. And for us, it was like growing up in England, you know, our sort of, you know, we were watching MonsterVision with Joe Bob Briggs, you know, on Channel 4.
Sure.
And, you know, we were watching The Burning and The Prowler. I mean, The Burning's a better film than The Prowler, but I think Tom Savini's work is masterful in The Prowler anyway. That was our access. Or going down to the local video store at the petrol station, the gas station, and, you know, all the video Nazis.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'd rent Prom Night 2, Hello Mary Lou, just simply because of the cover, you know. And that would be our in. I mean, we were far too young. But, I mean, that's why we're here. You know what I mean? That's the love of horror. It scars us, and also, you know, we fall deeply and madly in love. And so, paying respect to the past.
Just out of curiosity, because I had a similar experience, and I'm a dad now also. And so I am pretty permissive with what I let my kids see. As long as they can handle it, I don't really care what they watch. I don't think that they'll be screwed up by watching it any more than I was screwed up by watching, or, you know, by reading Stephen King when I was 11 years old, that kind of thing. It's, if you're going to watch it, you have access to a phone, you're going to see by far worse things than, you know, anything that you see on that shelf behind you. So yeah, if you want to, are there things like that that you limit for your kids, or do you want them to have a similar experience as you had and see things a little bit too young? Cause there's movies on there that I don't want to be the one to show him those movies, but I really want him to discover some of those at some point in time. It feels like kind of gross to say like, hey, go watch this thing. I don't want you to watch Last House on the Left on my recommendation, but if you happen to come across it, I'm okay with that.
I'm sort of, I have two daughters, and my
oldest, shit, a bad example for a movie.
And my eldest is six, and she loves genre. Like, I mean, I have horror posters in my house, so like she knows, you know, who Michael Myers is, she knows who Ghostface is. But it's interesting because, like, her friends at school, like, some of them, they don't watch Coco because it frightens them. All the parents tell me that. And I'm like, man, you know, my daughter's watching, you know, she's watching Corpse Bride. She's watching, you know. So there are, like, a few films I think that I would wait until she's a little bit older because I want the experience to be unforgettable. You know what I mean? Like, I think that's the only reason for holding off, perhaps, on some of these. But likewise, I'm with you. You know, I feel like, it comes down to our personal taste and knowing what our child can handle and what they're interested in. Because like for the three of us, you know, three men in their 40s, it was, we were watching those video nasties at far too young an age, you know. And I'd like to believe that we turned out as, you know, reasonable, you know, adults. So,
ish.
I'm completely thankful for that experience that I was subjected to that at such a young age, because that's part of my DNA now, as it is your guys as well. It's I wouldn't trade it for anything.
No, of course. If anything, there's the experience of watching something through your fingers, but you're still compelled by it. I think I saw Hellraiser when I was in fourth grade or something like that. And it was way too young. And now I go back and look at it. I didn't realize how much of a soap opera it was, but at the time it was the most horrific thing I had ever seen. I just didn't realize how heightened and silly it is. And I still love it, but it's in a different way. And so when I'm thinking about the art that I want my kids to consume, I don't want them to necessarily have the same taste as me, but I want them to be introduced to things before they'll write it off. So showing them silent films and Chaplin and Buster Keaton and stuff like that when they're really young, showing them, you know, the Ray Harryhausen films before they know what CGI is, so that they can get an appreciation of that, so they can still think it's cool because they're not cynical yet. But
And also the power of cinema in the past, you know, and how that has an effect on us. I remember even my eldest daughter, the only way that I could cut her nails was by playing Singing in the Rain on television. So she would watch that, then we could clip her nails and she wouldn't react, she wouldn't freak out, she'd be mesmerized by
of course
and then again just the power of magnificent cinema.
Absolutely. It's a universal thing. And even with that, when you don't even understand it, there's something in the visuals in that movie, specifically in that movie. I mean, my God, I'm not sure that you have more beautiful framing in a film than in that. It's just such an incredible movie. But
the greatest films of all time. Yeah.
So how are you feeling today? You're releasing your baby into the world. How is that? Is there a sense of nervousness right now? Or I believe you came out today, correct?
Yeah,
it came out today.
It's a very surreal feeling, kind of a bit sort of trepidatious and hopeful and excited. And mostly we just want, people to watch it, and experience it for good or for bad, to like take it in and, perhaps see something there that they haven't before.
Yeah.
This is an easy one to share and recommend. You talked about the video store kind of thing, and that was the best job I ever had. If I could still work at a video store to this day, that's what I would do. Just hang out and bullshit about movies all day and recommend things to people. That was one of my favorite things to do. Yeah. And this is a movie that I would gladly have put under my recommendations when I worked at the video store, because this is an easy one. I think that genre fans will absolutely be satisfied by this film. There's enough here that will, the Fangoria crowd will enjoy this for sure. But also, I think you could find people that maybe just want something that's a little bit exciting. I think you could have a crossover here with an appeal to this movie that goes beyond just the genre fans, because it's something that's pretty special, guys. I think you should be proud of this one.
Oh, thank you so much,
Christopher. We really appreciate that. And hopefully it does connect with audiences, for those reasons that you suggested. Yeah, which really...
No, they will. There's a... I have no doubt that this is one that people will share with each other, because this is the kind of movie that, I think it's kind of the timing is perfect on this, because everybody is going through their Anatomy of a Fall, Killers of the Flower Moon this weekend. And you could probably just use something a little bit more just, capital E entertaining right now. And this is certainly that. So I think this is a really nice way to spend this weekend. If you're caught up on all the Oscar films and you got something to check out this weekend, this is definitely a good one, Matt. So congratulations, guys. And I really hope there's more coming down the pike, because I don't want there to be a Sweet Virginia gap between that one and this again, because this is I'm a fan. I'm wanting to see the next one, guys.
Yeah, thank you so much. And hopefully the next one isn't as long. We've got a few things in the pipe, so hopefully it's sooner rather than later.
Very nice. Awesome. Well, thank you, guys. And I appreciate it. It was really nice to meet you. Hope you have a great weekend.
Thank you so much, Christopher. I really appreciate it.
Take care, guys. You as well. Take care. Bye-bye.
This episode of the Following Films podcast is brought to you by Bookmans. So today, I went into Bookmans and decided to try to find a film by Michael Mann. I went over to the Blu-ray section and saw copies of several films I already own, and then I found it. Black Hat. This is one I haven't seen in quite a while since it came out, and I figured maybe it was time for a reassessment of this much maligned film. So, Black Hat is a cybercrime thriller directed by Michael Mann that delves into the world of cybercrime, hacking, and international intrigue. While it promises to be a gripping exploration of the dangers lurking in the digital age, the execution falls short of expectations. The film follows convicted hacker played by Chris Hemsworth, who's temporarily released from prison to help the American and Chinese authorities track down a criminal network that's responsible for a series of major attacks. As the hunt takes them across the globe, Hemsworth's character must navigate the murky waters of the criminal underworld while grappling with his own demons. One of the film's major shortcomings is its lack of technical accuracy and realism. While it attempts to portray the world of hacking authentically, it often falls into cliches and inaccuracies that ultimately undermine the credibility of the story. So the hacking sequences are exaggerated and unrealistic, relying more on flashy visuals than genuine technical expertise. And this is coming from an absolute layman. I am not somebody who knows anything about hacking, and yet I can see some of the things that just flat out aren't true in this film. And that particular disconnect may disappoint viewers familiar with the subject matter or looking for a more grounded portrayal of cybercrime. So despite these flaws, though, Black Hat does have its moments. Michael Mann's signature style is evident in the film's beautiful, sleek cinematography and the signature action sequences. And the international setting adds depth to the narrative. It highlights the global nature of cyber threats and the challenges of international cooperation. Chris Hemsworth delivers a solid performance as Hathaway, bringing the character a sense of depth who's grappling for redemption. And the supporting cast includes, I had no idea, I'd completely forgotten this, but Viola Davis, who's really great in the film and adds a lot to the film. But ultimately, Black Hat falls short of its potential. While it offers a glimpse into the world of cybercrime and espionage, its lack of technical accuracy and reliance on cliches detracts from the overall experience. And despite its flaws, fans of Michael Mann's work or of the cyber thriller genre, I guess if you're a huge Johnny Mnemonic fan and you're looking for some more cyber thriller, you could do worse than Black Hat. However, for those seeking a more realistic, nuanced exploration of hacking and cybersecurity, this might leave you wanting more, and I'm not sure I can recommend this one. But despite that, this gave me the chance to check out a film that I've been meaning to reevaluate, because I keep hearing that Black Hat is an underrated film, and maybe I'll give it another 10 years, follow back up with this one, and see if it does end up coming around for me. But remember, Bookmans, they have your cool covered. Hope you enjoy the rest of the show. Thanks. Hey, Adam, how are you today?
I'm good. Are you Christopher or are you Chris?
Either way, I'm good. I'm good with either one. Usually Chris, but I'm Christopher Maynard. Sure, why not? Whatever you got. I'm happy nice to go by it. You as well. Congratulations on the film, man. You got something special here. I really enjoyed it.
So, oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
I'm 47, so I grew up at a time when films like this were commonplace, these adult-minded thrillers, and I feel like they just don't really exist in the way they once did, and this is just a really fun movie. It's not lighthearted by any means, but this is the type of film that I really cut my teeth on, that I grew up watching, and just feels like a throwback, I think, to something of the late 80s, early 90s that just felt very familiar, like a warm blanket to me in a way.
Oh, that's so cool. You're not the first person to say that.
So is that what made you approach this material or take it on?
No, I mean, I guess I didn't frame it in the thinking that way. I mean, there were definitely like touchstones to movies from that time period, like Jacob's Ladder.
Great movie, yeah.
Angel Heart. More recently, Shutter Island. Movies with kind of unreliable narrators in a way, that kept you guessing. I think I was sort of, I'm drawn to those. I think I'm drawn to stories where the characters and the viewer are kind of narratively in lockstep. So you're not omnisciently presenting content that they're not aware of. Or leading the audience, you're kind of peeling back the layers, unraveling the onion, sort of in step with the character. I like stuff like that.
Well, so do I. And there's something that you do here that I'm really glad you brought up those two films specifically, Angel Heart and Jacob's Ladder, where there are touches the whole time of what's going on. And you do this in your film also. And it's just something that you kind of, I think on the surface level, you recognize it almost immediately. You see something is maybe not quite what it seems, but you go along with it and just kind of accept it as the reality of this world and you push it to the side. And there's something that I think that it really does warrant, or a second viewing will be rewarded here, that you could see all the pieces are being laid out in front of you the whole time and you just didn't necessarily grab onto it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think given the nature of sort of what the narrative is, we had to be careful.
Of course,
I'm sure even in being careful, I think there are maybe certain top line organizing principles to the narrative that somebody who's perhaps schooled in film and story, won't be as easily misled maybe. And I guess that's okay. but you know, we did try to sort of drop Easter eggs, so everything felt earned in when you look back on the narrative. And it was always a little bit of sort of a dance and sort of figuring out which of those Easter eggs were too big an Easter egg or just the right size or not enough and wouldn't register. Yeah.
Well, it's something that you don't want to have a blinking light, a billboard that's pointing to the Easter egg, as it were, the sort right. of those things. But yeah, I think that those machinations of the plot, you can pay attention to those. But at the end, if it's just a good twist or it's a good turn, it becomes something that's empty. To me, like a movie like the original Saw, I didn't care for the movie. It didn't do much for me. It had an amazing ending that I didn't see coming. And it's something that almost fools you in the end. And so when you go back to it again, for me personally, and I'm like, oh, there really wasn't much here the whole time. It was just this ending that really got me the first time. The right. thing that if you have good performances and you have an interesting story that carries you through the way, all that stuff doesn't matter. That's just window dressing. It's really just the performances that I think are what carry this movie in the end that make this a compelling piece, even if you know exactly where it's headed. I think that
right.
Russell Crowe is just doing some incredible work here, which is just, he somehow went from leading man to one of the most interesting character actors working in the last 15 years. And it's been really fun to follow his later, this sort of, I guess, mid chapter of his career.
Yeah. It's very, it's a very subtle performance,
mm-hmm.
except for the moments when it's not. But it's a largely very, very subtle performance. And when I say even in the moments when it's not, I mean they're narrative moments when it demanded something else. It was a real treat to watch him do what he was doing. And I didn't even fully appreciate it until I was in post, honestly. Because you're moving so fast, just making sure you get everything that you need to get. That things like when you're in here tight on his face and he's doing what he's doing, particularly like at the end. Like that is a combination of amazing performance and really great music. By David Hirschfelder, because we were not doing very much with the camera.
But it's something that it's not doing much with the camera is the right choice in that, though, because you're playing it where it needs to play, because movement and elaborate setup and framing, if it's just for the sake of doing that and impressing, your friends that are then that doesn't really mean much.
Right.
It's something that can pull you out of it narratively. And I think that the film overall, it's top to bottom. This is something where I don't know what your budget was here, but it feels like probably something that's much smaller than what I assume it is. That it's something that this feels like you're punching above your weight to some degree, where this feels like, again, those movies from that time period that would have been those higher mid-budget films that just don't exist anymore.
Yeah, I think we had, in terms of like sort of what ended up on screen, it's probably about $9 million.
Oh my God.
That's
incredible. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, we were also shooting in Australia with a 40% tax credit.
That helps a little. So yeah.
Yeah. It was helpful. Yeah.
That's really incredible. That's something that I think that's inspiring. That it really does show that what you can do when you have just the performances dialed in like this, and you're using locations in a really impressive way. Like the house in this, I think probably elevates so much of this, because just an interesting home to look at that you can just, that adds production value for millions.
100%. You mean the house of the past?
Yes.
Yeah. So we, it took us a long time to find that house. A widowed woman, was living there with her two young children, and it was filled with antiques, which were her deceased husband's passion. And it took a really long time to find it, but we spent 9 days in that house shooting there. But everything, there wasn't a single set on that film that was built. Everything was everything was a practical location.
And it's really incredible when you do that, because it just does elevate things so much, and it makes it feel like this, you're just using the world that's there, but it's just getting the access to it. And it's using them for those right moments that this is, it just feels like a much bigger world than it actually is here. You can feel the edges of this film beyond the frames that exist, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah. It's interesting you say that, because my DP, when we would talk about just how we're telling story, he would frequently remind me, because I was, you know, a first time filmmaker. He would frequently remind me that we only show the audience what we want them to see. Yeah. Everything between the edges is imagination. And that was very instructive.
Well, it's something that it's what you don't show can be so powerful sometimes. And it's just, we start filling in those blanks on our own. And it's, you can almost say, no, I absolutely saw that. That was a part of it. And no, actually it was just we saw this from one side, it was pointed this way, and you never saw the rest of that whole thing. Yeah. And it's just, we start, film is always us filling in the blanks, just where we're creating movement where there never was any. So,
And that's, that's something that's kind of learned in a way, at least for me, because I think there's insecurity around how much you think you have to show. And I think audiences are so, you know, increased so much more intelligent than they used to be. I think just the way people consume content, and, you know, I think they're just more and more used to things. So having faith that you don't need to show as much as you think you do to tell your story is, I think, just, you know, part of the learning curve.
I think we can, on an unconscious level, an audience, we can feel when our hand is being held through something, and we can feel when there's confidence being given. And even though we might not digest every thought and idea and every setup in the way that it was intended, when we can feel intent and we feel like we're allowed to project ourselves into this and project our thoughts and opinions and our takeaways into it, it just gives us so much more, such a richer experience, other than, you know, I could sit here and tell you the story of Lawrence of Arabia, and I might be able to spin a good yarn, but, you know, if you look at, you know, 70 millimeter print of that, and you look at that photography, that's going to be a wildly different experience. And so showing is always so much better, and allowing people to make their own story, to me personally. Yeah. So, but I can't believe we're out of time already. These 10-minute things go so quick, but this is a hell of a film, man. So congratulations on it. I can't believe this is a first time effort. This is really impressive. So
that's so kind of you. Thank you.
No,
I think I'm at my point in the process with it where I totally hate it. Is that going to appear on your show or however you do?
I can pull that if you want to. That's fine. No,
just by nature of having lived with it a very long time.
Well, I mean, it's okay. So I can pull up my copy of Don Quixote that's back there, and in that, Cervantes says how much he recognizes the warts in this book. He can see that for what it is, and you see the warts in it, and you've gone through it so many times at this point. And those things that you might end up hating in the film, that you're like, if I had another chance, I would do this differently, could be the very things that make us love it. The broken nose makes you handsome sometimes. So it's, you have to just let it go, be out in the world. You're good on this one, man. And I want to see more. I'll tell you that much. So,
thanks,
yeah, I hope there's another one coming down the pike for you.
I hope so too. I mean, I'm working on stuff, but, you know, we'll see what happens. I hope so.
Awesome. Well, I hope I get to chat with you then, and I hope that I get to see it soon, because we need more voices like yours out there, Adam. So great job on this, man. Congratulations.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that.
Take care. Nice to meet you.
Likewise. Bye-bye.
Time enough to figure you out. Time enough to write this down. Wish me luck, give me hope.
my boys crack.